This is XTP Media.
You're listening to Extended. Your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, this is Aerospace Radio Station Extended. I'm Peter Johnson and welcome to episode 55. Today I'm joined by Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society, and Tim is the Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine. Tim, how are you?
Very well indeed, Peter. Hello, everybody.
And today we feature our second discussion on the Space Shuttle, and we're absolutely delighted to welcome back author of his latest sensational book, Into the Black, Roland White. Roland, welcome back.
Thanks very much indeed, Peter.
So today we get to talk some news. We got some feedback on our last episode, which has also proved extremely popular with Jeanette Remack. We've got some aviation books to talk about, some great aviation events to promote. So let's get started by what's caught our eye in the news. Okay, the first story we're going to pick up, and we can't really avoid talking about, Tim, is the UK air show update. We've seen this now spreading wider than the UK. We've just seen the reports on the Dutch hunters that can't fly because, of course, they're registered in the UK, so their permit to fly is no longer active. We've seen the Llandudno air show, Sewell, Manchester, and of course Shoreham all going by the wayside. Very sad, but we have seen a chink of a light coming through in terms of the CAA and some of these new regulations.
I mean, for people who've been following this story, obviously this is to do with the post Shoreham regulations and tightening of safety, you know, from that sort of sad episode accident last year. There's obviously been a lot written on it, a lot of ink put on it. People are worried that might kind of wipe out the smaller air shows. But equally, there's people saying that, you know, something like Shoreham must never happen again. So, you know, it's perfectly valid that these you know, regulations have to be looked at and tightened. So I don't think anyone's really sort of arguing against that the regulations shouldn't be, you know, looked at or strengthened. But it's the way in which it's gone about. So we've had, recently there was a kind of a war of words going on between the CAA, the British Air Display Association, and even the Guild of Air Pilots, who all got involved, and quite strong words exchanged between the two. They've now sort of kissed and made up a little bit. And what's come out of this now is that the CAA has said that the regulations they've put in, which people were very, some of the air shows were saying, you know, we can't possibly budget for this. This CAA has now said some of the post-show fees are going to be phased in over a period of time. So there has been a little bit of movement there. The CAA has also said something along the lines of, you know, if you've got special concerns, if you're a special case, you know, come to us and we'll have a discussion. A little bit of movement there. So I think having said that, we had obviously a petition. There was people kind of writing their MPs and that stuff, and obviously the, you know, Guild of Air Pilots getting involved. That sort of thing has had an effect, and that the CAA has sort of thought, oh, perhaps actually, you know, we want to sort of phase in some of these charges, not all of them, some of these charges, and just sort of take into consideration the fact that. It was all a bit last minute.
And Tim, some of the restrictions on the aircraft, mainly the Cold War jets, I think it is. Have we seen any movement on that? Because as I mentioned there, the Dutch hunters have been grounded, and it shows that this is spreading wider than the UK. But of course, we want to see some of the UK's Cold War jets as well.
I think it's going to be very difficult. I think it's very difficult for the CIA to come out and say, you know, vintage Cold War jets should be to lift any restrictions until the AIIB comes out with a final report on Shoreham. What actually happened? You know, was it human error? Was it mechanical failure? What was the actual cause behind that? Otherwise, you know, they're getting ahead of the cart a little bit.
Well, let's move on. You didn't get to join me recently for one of our extra episodes, Tim, because you were lording it up with Airlander. You went to see the new Airlander airship, didn't you? Tell us a little bit about that, and of course the deal we've seen today from Lockheed Martin.
Okay, well, so I went to see Airlander at Cardington. Very, very impressive. You know, seeing this huge 90-meter long, you know, airship in a hangar. It's more like a kind of a grounded UFO than a flying machine. Very, very impressive. You know, they have got it fully assembled now. The fins are on it. The engines are there. I was actually talking to him last week, and there was a kind of like engine sound in the background. The guy said, "Oh, don't worry about us. We're just doing an engine test here." So they are ready. There's obviously ground tests ahead they've got to do. And then they've got about 200 hours of actual flight tests, first flight, a flight test. They're not sort of saying when the first flight is, but obviously it's going to be fairly soon. And then they've got customer demos and trials sort of sorted out. So there's people already kind of very, very interested and overly keen, you know, I was one of the people who asked the CEO, you know, would you like to bring it to Farnborough? And he sort of said, well, you know, we'd love to, but, you know, depending on if we can do it safely. So, a lot of interest. They had their crowdfunding thing filled in record time.
Yeah, they did really well, didn't they?
And now also they've got a rival company that is trying to, you know, a similar thing. Airlander are going for kind of a tourism, aerial tourism sort of, and also maybe sort of government surveillance stroke patrol kind of thing first, like long endurance, and then moving on to like a bigger airship for cargo. Meanwhile, Lockheed Martin are going straight to cargo airships, and they've got a design for a hybrid airship, and a UK company last week signed a letter of intent for 12. So that's pretty interesting. So, you know, Lockheed Martin, this is their first civil, I think, venture into civil aviation since the 70s.
Since the TriStar, isn't it?
Yeah. So they obviously,
that went well for
there's money to be made for it. So they're going to invest in it as well. So you've got sort of like, you know, wait for ages to an airship to come along. Now you've got two at once.
And do we know, Tim, have we got any idea who Airlander's customers are? Is that public knowledge or not?
It's people who are interested. I mean, I was chatting with them. They've got various people kind of ringing up and sort of getting all excited. And some of them are getting a bit overly excited about. Airlander are being quite cautious about it. I mean, if we rewind to LEMV, obviously that was a spy airship, and Northrop Grumman was in charge there. Northrop Grumman was the prime contractor, and they're going to fly over Afghanistan. And I think Airlander are being are being quite clever in trying to walk before they can run. So, you know, it's got a hell of a lot of publicity now. People are getting excited, and now people are starting to sort of take a lot of interest, and they've got, you know, customers inquiring about it. But I think what they've got, they're trying to do is try to manage expectations a little bit and say, hey, this is still a prototype, you know. If they get an engine snag or something else, they've got to sit down and sort it out.
I mean, it's a tremendously exciting prospect, though. I mean, the idea of opening up a whole new market in civil aviation and a whole new experience for tourists and passengers who are kind of used to being sort of stuffed into 32-inch pitch seats in whatever airliner it might be, being able to sort of, you know, wander around and sort of take in the view potentially. I think is fantastic, and I really wish them well. And I'm, you know, first in the line for that, because it may be just a little bit more affordable than that flight on the on Spaceship Two or Blue Origin. If I were a rich man, I'd pay for.
It could be ultra green as well. I mean, if you think of something like the Grand Canyon or flying over Africa
or the Arctic.
Yeah, you think how much sort of the battery efficiency of electric motors have come in the past 10 years, and also kind of flexible solar panels, you know. That is a real, you know, that's a sort of like a, even your Guardian reader could fly one of those things and without a sort of like, a, you know, feeling guilty.
Yeah, maybe not Farnborough.
maybe not. Tim, let me ask a question I'm sure was asked when you went up with the rest of the press folks to HAV. How does weather affect its performance? Because to me, it just, you know, we had probably the worst storm we've had in decades where I live last week, 70 to 100 mile an hour winds. Now, no one's expecting to fly in that, but Britain's not got the greatest weather. How does it deal with I suppose a little bit of wind?
Well, obviously your forward speed is going to be hit by it if you know. So the cruising speed is about 18 knots.
18 or 80?
80. 18, right. 80 knots. And yeah. They've basically got to kind of plan around whether, you know, much as an ocean going yacht would kind of avoid thunderstorms.
Can it go IMC? Or is it planned to go IMC into cloud? And
I think it would be able to. Yeah. I don't see why not. I mean, your Zeppelins used to do that, so I don't see why you'd have any. You probably have to watch maybe the build up of ice a little bit.
I bet they don't make the comparison with Zeppelins very often.
Well, it was amazing when you said I went up to Cardington, because of course that just immediately brings memories and a picture of the old days and you know, the airships. I mean, just the word to me brought a whole plethora of historical images to mind.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I think you know, like I say, they're trying to go for the aerial tourism or border surveillance, whatever, somewhere where you could go to a base at night. Whereas if the cargo thing, if you're going round, you've got to have the ground infrastructure there. You know, you've got to have this kind of ground infrastructure, and you know, obviously the Cardington heart hangars are big, but you can, you know, you think about some of the inflatable structures you can have for stealth bombers these days. So, you know, they're pretty, you know, massive. It's not beyond the wit of man to sort of say, well, you know, could you have an inflatable hangar that would protect it, and you put that under there and kind of anchor it, you know, in sort of bad weather.
And what sort of unrefueled endurance are they talking about, Tim?
Well, they reckon they can get halfway around the world on a single tank of gas.
That's just fantastic.
It is extremely economical, you know, but with a small payload. So you're only talking about sort of, 10 tons of the Airlander 10 we've got. Mm-hmm. It's like a sort of a C-295, which is, you know, tactical transport.
Yeah.
But even that, people are sort of saying, people are getting excited, like some of the sort of sensor guys I've talked to about, you know, how much sort of sensors, cameras, defensive aid systems, comms links you could put on the thing and have it as some kind of like super ISR platform that would just hang about and loiter over the battlefield.
Yeah, well, in terms of tech, I mean, everything's getting smaller and smaller and smaller. I mean, the only thing that they're going to find is getting bigger is people.
Well, on that point, then we'll leave Airlander there and move on. Blue Origin, Roland, fantastic milestone they achieved this week. Third time in a row of a suborbital spacecraft being reused, isn't it? This is fantastic. We've seen SpaceX doing this. We're moving into a new spectrum of space exploration.
I mean, I think we are. The thing which really struck me watching the video of Blue Origin's most recent flight was the way that the launch stage comes down. I mean, it looks like it's returning to Earth like a cannon shell, and then suddenly slows down. I mean, it comes down, comes in so fast, it's stunning to watch. And then you realize the extent to which the computers are making sure that it lands safely. But you realize that's the only way that the thing can be controlled, is the power and the capability of those computers to ensure that it remains stable. I mean, it's really stunning to watch, and you know, it's an incredible achievement to fly that three times. And you know, there's no doubt at all that it's ushering in a new era, along with obviously SpaceX's efforts as well. And you know, it's an interesting sort of PR game that they're that both those companies are playing. And it does feel as if outside of aficionados, Jeff Bezos seems to be sort of gaining ground, because I'm not sure that there's much appreciation of the great difference there is between having to put something in orbit and just getting something above the Kármán line. And they're two significantly and substantially different challenges.
We've also seen, of course, we're just about to see the Bigelow inflatable unit, Tim, go to the ISS as well. We're seeing some massive changes in innovation in space technology.
Yeah, I mean, that's the inflatable or expandable, if you want to be perfectly correct and technically correct, expandable habitat that's going to go on the ISS. That's going to be the first private structure on the ISS that's been there. Going to be inflated, expanded, and then the astronauts are going to, not going to live in it. It's got no heating and no power and no lights. But it is going
much like Apollo 13.
But yeah, exactly. Yeah, but they're going to have a look and see how it fares while it's on the space station. So basically, this opens up, if it works, it opens up things like, you know, because you've got you can pack in these smaller volume, but then kind of it grow to big kind of large habitats. Things like, you know, space hotels, space factories, working areas. Send us to the moon or Mars, and you can have them there, you know, as somewhere where, you know, the Martian could live. But probably, I think probably the most interesting thing for that sort of thing is I'm hopefully that this gets pursued at some point, is as some kind of rotating artificial gravity kind of donut. And NASA did look at this in the 60s. It's kind of like tire company. I think the Goodyear was looking at it. Possibly Goodyear. I might be wrong on this, but there's kind of like a concepts of a donut shaped small space station that was inflatable, and they were looking at it back then. But now the technology's improved. You know, you've got stuff like Kevlar. Things like that.
Amazing stuff. Before we leave the news, though, just wanted to talk about supersonic airliners. We could probably talk forever on it, but Virgin have got their name now in the game, and that always gets some good TV and newspaper time. Is this realistic, you know, or are we just going through the same old Resurrect Concorde message?
Well, I mean, it seems realistic, doesn't it? The team that that Virgin have attached themselves to, because they're not essentially trying to do anything new. They're not looking for low boom technology. They're looking for something that really just does what Concorde did, but obviously it's smaller and with modern materials and lighter weights and more efficient engines. It makes the job of doing what Concorde did a little bit easier. But they're not. They don't appear to be attaching themselves to somebody who's advancing technology in the way that the outfit that Airbus have backed are doing.
Yeah, and also NASA are also putting an awful lot of pages out on social and national media on the work that they're doing. And I don't know how politically correct it is to say they should have backed Concorde in the first place, but it does seem a little bit like reinventing the wheel.
I'm going to have to strike a sort of a dissenting note, actually, with that latest one, because there's some interesting CVs on the team there at Boom, and obviously, you know, you wish them all the best, but they said they'd raised, was it, £6 million or something like that, or, 11 people, which strikes me as a little bit sort of, ambitious, and they're talking about, I don't know, getting a thing, something flying by the end of 2017. So, unless there's a whole load of, venture capitalists who just throw money at it. And also the input from Virgin. Well, okay, you know, Virgin Galactic and stuff. But Virgin Galactic have got their own problems. They've got to get, cracking on the, Spaceship Two. So, I think it's pretty ambitious.
Yeah, I can't help but be sceptical. As much as I'd love to see it happen, I wonder whether a few kind of digitally rendered images are the best we'll see.
And the problem I think it also is going to be, and I think Arian are hitting this as well, is what engine do you use? Because you're invariably going to be driven into a military type solution. Unless you can convince one of the big boys to sink money into developing kind of a high end biz jet to have reheat or go supersonic or something like that. So it's going to be military, and then you've got the other problem of okay, you might be able to kind of reduce the boom in flight, and you might have to put a kind of shaping on it and that, but then. If you've got a military engine like an EJ200, we all know how noisy they are on takeoff around an airport. So how do you get around the chat noise restrictions around a busy airport? Would you have to lobby and then get the special dispensations to fly only during the day? Or it's not as simple as that.
Hmm. I'd like to still see the progress that's being made on the reaction engines and see where that goes as well. So good luck to all of those.
Yep.
But I think we'll leave the news there because we want to get back to talk to Roland about the latest book, Into the Black.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation and most of all the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
Okay, and obviously this episode we have our very special guest and friend of extended back again, Roland White, aviation author, aerospace author, space author, extraordinaire.
Space author now.
Author now. Back to talk about his recently published masterpiece, Into the Black, which if you haven't read it by now, you should do. Every AvGeek on Twitter is now posting pictures of it. Roland, first question, is it a relief it's all over? How long did it take?
It did take sort of 3 or 4 years from when I first started printing off reams and reams of documents from NASA's websites. And I mean, that it was, 19, it wasn't the 2000s at least. Something like 2012, I think, where I first thought, this is the story I really want to do. And it was, as I mentioned last time I was on, it came about as a result of the shuttle capturing my imagination as a kid. As is so often the case with any of these stories, actually, as soon as you start scratching the surface, you realize that it's far, far more interesting than you had thought it was from a distance.
I mean, just expand on obviously, for those who haven't got Into the Black yet, what are you waiting for? But it tells a story of the link between spy satellites, the aborted MOL, manned orbiting laboratory, and the first flight of the shuttle. But how did that kind of grab your imagination? And whatever angles, whatever stories were you looking at the same time, thinking, That might make a good one as well.
It's interesting in that you mentioned the spy satellites and the manned orbiting laboratory, and that none of that was in my mind at all when I started work on it. That it all emerged later on. I mean, I got into it thinking this was the first spacecraft that captured my imagination, and one of the reasons for that was that it had wings. I mean, that was the main reason for it. Actually, it had wings. I was an AvGeek. I grew up loving airplanes, loving things with wings, loving the size of a Phantom or a Lightning flying over. And so these sort of spidery contraptions that had sent people to the moon inside really held no appeal for me at all. I mean, the you know, the most attractive image I thought there was of an Apollo spacecraft was the picture there was in the Airfix catalogue of a Sea King helicopter fishing the astronauts out of the sea. And so it wasn't until we saw the space shuttle with wings come hurtling into land at Edwards Air Force Base and identifiably be part of a continuum that sort of began with Chuck Yeager and the Bell X-1 in the skies over the Mojave Desert that I really got interested. And it was crucial, that difference, because timing obviously was important. I was too young really to be grabbed by Apollo. But it felt like the world's first real spaceship. It was something which was designed to do a job. You know, I mean, the shuttle was, at the time that it flew, it was like Han Solo's Millennium Falcon. You know, it was a freighter. It was genuine. You know, it was a freighter that was the fastest ship in the galaxy. You know, never really got sort of credit for that. In fact, I think NASA was probably lucky they didn't end up having to call one Millennium Falcon, because you'll remember that they were originally going to call Enterprise, the prototype they flew off the back of 747, Constitution. And then there was a letter writing campaign by Star Trek fans insisting that they call it Enterprise, and so they changed the name, much to the chagrin of some of the astronauts.
I would have voted for Millennium Falcon.
Yeah, no,
so, it
would be great, wouldn't it?
So, it's out in the wild. What's the promotion cycle like for an aviation book? Have you done many sort of book signings, interviews?
I've done a few interviews and things. There've been some reviews in newspapers. I'm doing a few more bookshop events. I think there are a couple more reviews which are coming as well. But it's interesting. I mean, I think the book trade sort of changed a lot over the last 10 years or so. And 10 years ago, at a time where, you know, people were wailing about the idea that the supermarkets, the power of the supermarkets might kill publishing and kill the book trade, you were able to sort of shoehorn large quantities of a small selection of books into the supermarket. Markets and into Smiths and into Waterstones, and almost dictate what the public was exposed to, and as a result, what they bought. But nowadays, the relative power of supermarkets in comparison to the high street Waterstones independent bookshops has declined when it comes to book selling, and their range is much, much smaller. And that's come at the same time as people have been able to talk to each other and about what they like and what they don't like much more directly on social media. And so we're seeing now that much smaller numbers of a greater number of titles tend to go into bookshops. And then the ones which people like, and the ones which they hear about from friends or through social media, tend to be the ones that emerge. So it's a sort of longer job of hand selling and a sort of longer tail now when it comes to, you know, trying to sell a book. It's sort of turned into the opposite of you mentioned this earlier when we were talking to him. It's turned into the sort of opposite of the movie business, where they know whether a movie's going to work or not on the strength of its first weekend's numbers. And that's not true of the book trade anymore. I mean, certainly books can get off to a flying start, but very often those that do tend to disappear quite quickly. What's almost a healthier state of affairs is to sell a solid number week in, week out, and have people really enjoy it and tell their friends about it. And, you know, my job, I suppose, now is to just do everything I can to sort of keep that conversation alive and make sure that there are, you know, as many opportunities as possible for people who haven't come across it to hear about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's interesting because, you know, one of the things that struck me about Vulcan 607 was it made the leap from a niche aviation book that, you know, to a kind of a mass market title, and you'd find it in kind of, you know, W. H. Smith's in you know, airports and things like that. What's the reaction been, especially from US readers and reviewers?
Well, I've been staggered actually by the reaction, I've got to say. I mean, when I was on last time, I think we only heard from Chris Hadfield, which was exciting enough that he had enjoyed it. But since then, got it into the hands of a number of different astronauts, including David Scott, commander of Apollo 15, and Michael Fole has read it as well. Tom Jones, Mike Mullane, Homer Hickam, who wrote Rocket Boys, and a number of ex-Air Force and NASA historians as well. And the reaction has been, you know, I'm really happy to say, you know, universally enthusiastic. And you know, I'm continuing to try to get it into the hands of people who might enjoy it and might help sort of bang the drum for it. So I think sending a copy off to Scott Kelly tomorrow, actually, and then I'm hoping next week that I might try and get one certainly a little closer to Tim Peake as well. I'm not sure we'd quite be able to deliver it to the space station.
Put it on a Blue Origin.
It's not going to get it any higher. I don't think that I'm trying to get a copy of the book. But I've been looking at the possibility on the 35th anniversary of the first launch of the shuttle, first launch of Columbia, which is April the 12th, so next week, of attaching a copy of Into the Black to weather balloon and seeing how high we can get it over in the skies above Sheffield. It seems to me sort of a fitting occasion to just mark the shuttle's first flight. And, well, you know, it's not quite confirmed, but I'm really, really hoping we'll be able to do that. We should get some amazing video and photographs out of it as well. And as I was saying, it'd be another opportunity just to tell people that the book is out there.
You heard it here first, folks.
Whether or not Major Tim will be able to see it out of the cupola window of the ISS is doubtful. You know, it's the best I can do, short of talking to SpaceX.
Go back to the shuttle program itself,
yeah.
And you know, SSTS-1. I mean, what was your biggest surprise or wow? I did not know that from doing the research. I mean, no, obviously now you could talk freely and let us into all the secrets.
Yeah, I mean, I talked a little bit about secrets last time, but I mean, I think the thing that really staggered me was starting to get to grips with the numbers involved. I mean, I mentioned that I'd started with the book, wanting it to be a celebration of what I think is without doubt the most extraordinary flying machine the world has ever seen. You know, it flew faster, it flew higher than anything else that's ever been built. And it also represented the last of the line. You know, if you talk about the Bell X-1 1947 and you've got a line going through the X-15 and you've got the SR-71. And the last time that there were any new records broken by a brand new American design was in the mid-70s with the F-15 Streak Eagle. And that there were some time to climb records rather than outright speed or outright height. And so after that point, the only machine and the distillation, I suppose, of all of that post-war expertise in American aviation was the shuttle, and it became, you know, the highest flying, fastest flying winged vehicle the world's ever seen. It's never really been, I don't think, appreciated for that. But then you compare it with an X-15, which is a tiny little thing which carries one pilot, and you know, the shuttle's the size of an airliner, and you look at it next to a capsule, and you realize that the heat shield for the capsule is about the size of a big dining table. You know, the shuttle's the size of a tennis court, and they had to protect that from the heat of re-entry. And the numbers around the re-entry are absolutely staggering. I mean, the shuttle hitting the atmosphere at 17,500 miles an hour, which is the orbital speed, contained the same kinetic energy as a Nimitz-class aircraft carrier weighing 100,000 tons. Shuttle weighed just 85,000 tons. So the same kinetic energy as a Nimitz-class aircraft carrier, if that is, that Nimitz-class aircraft carrier was steaming along at 500 miles an hour. I mean, you know, the heat generated by the shuttle on re-entry and the compression wave just ahead of the bottom of the nose was 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's the same as the temperature of the surface of the sun. It's not close to it. It's the same as the temperature on the surface of the sun. Now, the shuttle skin itself didn't quite have to endure that sort of temperature, but it did have to endure 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And carbon steel melts at 2,600 degrees Fahrenheit. And aluminium, and I know you talked about this with Jeanette in the last episode, aluminium, the melting point of aluminium is just 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit. So you're talking about some, you know, incredible numbers. And you know, that was the thing that I think I most enjoyed about this. And it was kind of a reaction to the last book, Stormfront, which was very kind of down and dirty, sort of set in a sort of secret war in Oman involving very complicated airplanes, you know, Huey helicopters and Strike Masters. After finishing that, I really wanted to get my head around something more complicated and really kind of get stuck into the science and the engineering. And you know, my God, the shuttle really offered that opportunity. As I say, you know, the numbers, the science is extraordinary. And again, I don't think that, you know, certainly since the days of the first few flights, people have really appreciated just how extraordinary a machine it was. And I started off the book wanting to remind people of that, remind people of the sort of sense of wonder and awe that had the authors of The Dangerous Book for Boys, certainly naming it as one of the seven modern wonders of the world. And it was only once I got started on it and realized that there was this sort of dramatic counterpoint involving spy satellites and secret space station programs and a race against time to discover whether or not Columbia was going to return safely, that I had my hands on what was a real life thriller. You know, I was able to turn what was going to be a celebration into a book that, you know, I thought had the possibility of reading a little bit like, you know, Gravity or Apollo 13 or The Martian. Yeah. Real, you know, I wanted, as I did with the other three books, actually, to write a book that, even though it was rigorously researched and historically accurate and, you know, everything could be kind of, everything was properly rooted in fact, read like a thriller. I just wanted people ripping through the pages.
No, it's a real kind of gripping read, even though, you know, like Apollo 13, you know what the kind of conclusion is going to be.
So
you mentioned, obviously, well, previous guest Jeanette, she was on there, and she's written a book of investigation to slip the Surly Bonds. Looking at her take on poor design decisions on the shuttle, what do you make of that? It's kind of is it the anti Into the Black in a way?
Not really. I mean, you know, she talked about aluminium, and she talked about the tiles as possibly sort of flawed decision making. I mean, I spoke to Tom Moser, who was head of the structures division at Houston at Johnson Space Center as the design for the shuttle was taking shape. And he visited, in fact, he made two interesting visits as he was trying to establish the best way of building the structure of the shuttle. One of them was to Lockheed Skunk Works. And he climbed all over SR-71s, which were in there for maintenance. And he saw them milling titanium. And he talked to the engineers who, you know, had been suffering for a decade or more working with titanium there. And he said to them, look, we're going to build the shuttle. This is what it's got to do. We could build it out of aluminium, or we could build it out of titanium. What do you recommend? And without hesitation, every one of those Skunk Works engineers said, aluminium or aluminum. And so, you know, certainly there was a reluctance to work with titanium, which is a notoriously tricky metal to work with, because everything just breaks when you try to machine it. But it was the recommendation of those Lockheed Skunk Works engineers that they build the shuttle out of aluminium. But as an interesting aside to that, Tom Moser also took a trip as he was trying to work out the best way of dealing with the enormous variation in heat that the shuttle had to deal with from, as I mentioned, you know, temperatures which it was generating that were similar to the to those found on the surface of the sun, to obviously freezing when you were out of sunlight. And metal, any metal, is going to expand and contract in that situation. And this, there are two important points that that raises. One is the structure and how that bends and flexes in when exposed to different heats. And that was something that Concorde also, like the Blackbird, like the SR-71, had to contend with. So Tom Moser flew to Filton, to British Aerospace, or BAC as it was then, and talked to the engineers at Filton about how Concorde dealt with heat. And they built complicated, very sophisticated expansion joints into Concorde, which allowed it to get, I think, over 6 inches longer when it was flying at supersonic speed at altitude than it was when it was on the ground. And that seemed like a sort of overly elaborate solution to him. And so he decided he was just going to build an aluminium structure that was strong enough to endure all of the stresses and strains that the variations in heat, variations in G loads that it was going to have to face. And so that's what he did. He built a strong aluminium structure based on what he'd learned at BAC and at Lockheed Skunk Works. But that also connects directly to the issue of the tiles. I mentioned that, you know, metal expands and flexes and bends and warps when subjected to heat. That's no good if you want to build a reusable heat shield. You know, you couldn't have built a reusable heat shield, or even an ablative heat shield on the shuttle, because an ablative heat shield, one which kind of destroys itself as it protects the thing it's attached to, is by definition not reusable. A metal heat shield would, even if it were tiles or plates, would have buckled when subjected to heat, and that would have created gaps through which the plasma gas could have reached the airframe below. So they had to find a structure that was essentially as impervious to heat as the surface of the desert. I mean, you know, sand does not expand or contract when subjected to extremes of temperature. And so they built the heat shield out of sand. But of course, as Jeanette rightly pointed out, sand, or the silica tiles that they created out of sand, were very, very brittle. So you couldn't have it all. And so you couldn't build, you could have a really, really effective heat shield made out of silica tiles. But what you couldn't do was build it out of big sheets, because as that metal airframe underneath bent and flexed, it would smash the tiles that were attached to it. So that sort of elaborate mosaic of 30,000 or so tiles that they built out of silica was the best solution available for what they needed to do. And, actually, in fairness to the solution that NASA engineers came up with, it was pretty robust. You know, it didn't actually let the shuttle down, except when it was subjected to, an assault by a chunk of foam from the tank. You know, the orbiter itself, and, you know, the shuttle's often criticized as flawed, because obviously two crews were tragically lost on when Challenger exploded and when Columbia broke up. But on neither occasion was it the fault of the orbiter. First time round, the SRB obviously blowtorched the struts and the structure, and essentially it crumpled as a result of aerodynamic loads. And that led to the explosion. It simply couldn't cope with that sort of stress and strain. It had never been designed to. And then when Columbia was lost, it was as if somebody had hit the leading edge of the wing with a sledgehammer. I mean, you know, you wouldn't expect any airplane to have to deal with that kind of violence. I mean, it might be able to, but it's certainly not designed to be able to, unless it's, you know, an A-10 tank buster, and, you know, the shuttle certainly was not that. Yeah. So often criticism of the shuttle itself is or the orbiter for the failures of the tragedies of Challenger and Columbia are a little unfair, I think, because it was not on either occasion the fault of the orbiter. which is the thing that we all obviously kind of just, you know, sort of keep in mind when we think of the shuttle. On both occasions, it was a failure of something else.
Yeah, interesting. I love the fact that the little kind of thing in your book about you know, the race to put the tiles back on, and you know, sort of, well, tiles on the tiles that had fallen off on the first, you know, the transferring it, and the fact that they got kind of all hands to the deck on NASA, and that they were using a DC-3.
Yeah, well, that was to train people
to put, you know, kind of a great sort of. You mentioned
that's not my favourite story about the tiles. My favourite one, I mean, I had to include it, even though there was no really good reason for doing so. It was somebody who was entirely kind of off their own bat, wanting to see how the tiles would cope with a bird strike, and so they attached tiles to the front of a car, and then drove into a flock of chickens, which I'm sure came out of the experiment in a worse state than the tiles or the car.
Now, you mentioned obviously in the book the military role of the shuttle, and that the links with the classified world. And you know, one of the things people sort of say is, you know, I kind of argue is you know, what was the point of the shuttle? What did it achieve? You know, and there's various things that put forward, like, you know, servicing of the Hubble telescope. But you point out that, you know, that the helping bankrupt the Soviet Union in a way.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's you know, maybe that's slightly sort of stretching a point, but. Not really. I mean, the Soviet Union obviously had a very successful space program, and they were putting people into space for extended periods aboard space stations. And there was a large contingent within the Soviet space community that had plans to build a permanent moon base. But as soon as the US plans for the shuttle were announced, the Soviets got their best scientists onto the program or to look into the program and try and establish what the real reasons for building a shuttle might be, because they didn't trust the announcements made by NASA about its intentions. And they concluded that there was simply no scientific reason for building a space shuttle. And so there must be a military imperative behind it, and they concluded that it was going to be used and be capable of delivering a first strike nuclear weapon without warning against Moscow by diving down into the atmosphere and boosting itself up again. You know, that was the mentality in the Cold War. I mean, they were paranoid, and they believed that and partly because their own space program was inextricably linked to the military, whereas you know, America had two. It had NASA and it had the US Air Force space program. They couldn't see that it had anything but a military function. And so they said, we've got to build one too. They didn't know what the Americans were going to use their shuttle for, but they just said, we have to have something which is has the same capability as the American system. And they had done quite a lot of research into shuttles themselves, and had plans for a spiral space plane, which used a Soviet design and looked very, very different to the space shuttle. But in the end, Soviet engineers were ordered by the superiors, by management, to simply follow the mold line of the American shuttle, on the basis that the Americans had done all research and the Americans were not dumber than the Soviets. And I had a great story from one of the astronauts, I think it was from John McBride, or Rick Hawke, I think, two of the TFNGs, the 35 new guys generation of astronauts, who had spoken to the chief Soviet shuttle designer and joked, oh, great, you know, you obviously copied your design from Rockwell. And this guy, I mean, unsurprisingly, I suppose, really had his nose put out of joint and said, well, you know, if you're going to be the second person to build a bicycle, it's going to look like a bicycle, but it doesn't mean it's not a better bicycle.
Right, I've got we've got Peter here with some questions from our listeners for you. But final question from me is, what's next on the list then? So you obviously could kind of take it easy for a bit before you start the next book, but any hints as to what we might sort of see next?
There's a few things I'm sort of scratching. I mean, I've really been bitten by the space bug doing this. I suppose what I'd like to do almost, and I think I mentioned this last time round, and it's taken shape a little bit more, certainly in my mind, is almost write a sort of companion piece to Into the Black. And I called it last time round In Search of the Real Dan Dare, which would trace a story from sort of Eric Brown flying the Messerschmitt Comet at the end of the Second World War through to Dave Mackay, Virgin's chief test pilot and Boscombe Down fixed wing squadron test pilot, Harrier pilot, flying Spaceship Two into space for the first time. I think there's really fertile material. It's a question of trying to stitch it together, and if I possibly can, I will. But you know, there's all sorts of really fascinating stuff you can weave into that. Whether or not that actually comes to life, sees the light of day, I'm not sure. It's very early days yet, and it depends to some extent on whether I can navigate, find a sort of through line through it and really turn it into a story rather than a slightly sort of disparate collection of anecdotes. That's going to be the challenge. But in fact, I've had a sort of first stab at some of the material in the April edition of The Aviation Historian. Which I think is coming out in a couple of weeks' time. And it seems to me that what might be key to it is the relationship between Edwards Air Force Base and the test pilot community there and the Empire Test Pilot School and Boscombe Down, and the very, very kind of rich and successful exchange program that there's been throughout the whole of the 20th century and since. You know, I mean, Rick Husband, who was the commander of Columbia on her final mission and was killed during re-entry, was the very last pilot to fly the Buccaneer in British military service, for instance. Nigel Wood, who was assigned to NASA as a mission specialist to accompany the launch of Skynet satellite in the early 80s, who never flew after Columbia, after Challenger was lost, had been on the exchange program at Edwards, where he was flying the F-15 in an evaluation against the F-16 XL's replacement for the F-111. So, I mean, I think I mentioned this last time, but that's where the story lies. And in the Aviation Historian, I've written about Ivan Kinchlow, who was labelled America's first spaceman after flying the X-2, the Bell X-2, above 100,000 feet for the very first time, was trained by Empire Test Pilot School at the same time as you know, a number of Tony Woodman and Jeffrey Higgs, both of whom sort of well-known British test pilots, were at Empire Test Pilot School. So the relationship goes, you know, way back.
And I believe wasn't Tim Peake at the Empire Test Pilot School as well?
Absolutely, he was at Boscombe Down as well. So, no, I mean, exactly right. It's really, really fertile ground. In fact, as evidence of my seriousness, my history of the Empire Test Pilot School arrived in the post today from Amazon. So I can't remember what it's called. It is called Learn to Test, Test to Learn.
Right. Do you know what, Roland? I'm not saying this because you're on here, but you write the books I want to read.
Come on, thank you. And that one, of course, isn't yet written. But
well, you're going to have to write it now.
if I write it, that even though you kind of know that it didn't happen, I hope you'll kind of feel that things like HOTOL did. You'll kind of feel that things like Mustard did, and you'll kind of feel that the SR-53 rocket jet mixed propulsion great, fighter really was an X-15 type thing.
Make a great alternate history novel, wouldn't it? A bit like kind of Ministry of Space, if anyone's ever read that kind
well,
of...
Well, yeah, Ministry of Space is great. And I'd also send anyone who's really interested in this stuff in the direction, you can buy this online, of a magazine called Interzone, a science fiction magazine. Go for issue 112 of Interzone magazine, which was published in October 1996, and Stephen Baxter in that, who some people will love, wrote a story in there called Prospero One, about the first British manned spaceflight, which is a lovely, lovely piece of speculative fiction.
Right. Well, let's get on to some more questions for you, Roland. I have a bag full myself, but I think I'm going to have to put a few of those on hold. So let's get to some of the listener questions. First one, I feel obliged to ask you. It's from Jo Ayres. She says, where can she get a signed copy of your book from?
If Jo wants to direct message me on Twitter or email me through my website, I'd be really, if she just sends me a copy to work, actually, I mean, if anyone wants to send me a copy to work, I work at Penguin Books. The address is Penguin Books, 80 Strand, London, WC2R0RL. I will sign it and post it back to them. But, I mean, it may be easier just to email me through the website or direct message me on Twitter, but I'm really, really happy to do that and get it back to people. In fact, I've done three or four already.
Right. Well, I'm going to have to bring mine up to London next time. Okay.
Well, you get to do it over a pint.
I know, we've got to. Then let's get to Jeanette from the last episode. And I think if there's something that's come out of all of this, I not only reading Jeanette's book, reading yours, and I am wading through, as a recommendation from you, the Haynes manual on the shuttle as well, which is pretty good.
Yeah.
Is the knowledge and understanding of the shuttles. It is an absolutely amazing piece of technology, and some of the words that were used in the book about, you know, if everybody is as diligent as some of the workers, you know, it won't fail because of me, you know. Yeah. I thought that was a fantastic line. But anyway, let's get on to Jeanette's questions for you. She says, Richard Truly and Bob Crippen grew with the shuttle system. What were their thoughts about some of the construction issues on the shuttle? We mentioned aluminium earlier and of course the tiles and foam and things like that. Was it too political for them to have a voice, or
no, not at all? I mean,
were
I
they
don't,
just being good test pilots?
I don't think they had any issue with the aluminium structure whatsoever. I mean, I really don't. And I mean, I'm slightly at odds with Jeanette there, in that I don't think there was any necessity to build a titanium structure. It might have been nice, but it would have created difficulties of its own, and as I say, it wasn't necessary. Certainly it wasn't something that I think was questioned by the astronauts. The tiles certainly caused more consternation, only because it was so conspicuously evident that they weren't sticking on, and you know, everybody on the program was really concerned about it. It wasn't that they weren't it wasn't a potentially great heat shield, it really was, but if they couldn't get the tiles to stick to the felt, the Nomex felt that was underneath, that was between the airframe, the aluminium airframe, and the tiles, then the shuttle was just not going to fly. You couldn't fly without a robust enough heat shield. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't until an engineer at Houston, who was in the lab over the weekend, tried simply mixing silicon powder with water and painting it onto the bottom of the tiles, and in a process which became known as densification, what he really did was smooth out the sort of rough bottoms of the tiles by in the way that sort of, you know, a talcum powder mixture or trying to think of something else. You know how when you mix very, very fine custard powder, very, very fine powder with water, it becomes very firm. And that sort of paste is what they pasted onto the bottom of the tiles, made of exactly the same thing, you know, silica and water. And then they would bake them. And it meant that the bottom was smooth enough for the connection, the meeting between the felt and the tile to be secure. And so that they had to take a lot of them off and reapply them using densified tiles. But it wasn't until they did that and realized that they were going to be robust enough that they knew that they could fly. And certainly that flight that Jeanette talked about from California to Kennedy Space Center, the people who were in charge of the heat shield knew that a lot of those tiles were, I mean, a lot of the tiles hadn't been attached in the first place. There was a lot of polystyrene on there, which was just supposed to look like tiles for the purposes of the flight. So it wasn't quite as grave a situation as I think some commentators suggested it was. But, you know, the tiles were a concern.
The first of two questions from Tumbles on Twitter, and I think you just answered it. He says, is it true that felt was used to hold the heat tiles onto the aluminium frame?
Felt wasn't used to hold them onto. I mean, they could have glued the tiles directly onto the aluminium frame, and it would have actually been easier to do. But if they'd done that, you wouldn't have the foam, or rather the felt, wouldn't have absorbed the movement of the aluminium underneath. You know, that's the thing, an airframe flexes. And if you'd attached these very brittle tiles directly to the aluminium, even though the heat wouldn't have made it through because they were such poor conductors of heat, they would have broken split the heat shield. So they didn't use the felt to attach the tiles to the airframe. They used the felt simply to absorb the movement of the airframe without damaging the very delicate heat shield that was attached beyond it.
Okay, then let's we'll stick with Tumbles then. He says, can we get a book on the Saturn program or programs that were never completed? And also, why did you choose the shuttle?
I'm not going to write a book about the Saturn program, I'm afraid. there's quite a lot of really good stuff written about about Saturn, about the rocket and Apollo. I mean, I'd Google that if you, I mean, a chap called David Portry writes some really good stuff about some of the Apollo programs that never quite came to fruition. You know, some of the plans that were devised and never pursued. A blog called The High Frontier is also worth looking at, and some good stuff on there as well. But I'd just sort of Google, I'd play around on the internet, and you'll find some interesting stuff there about some of the never pursued Apollo and Saturn programs. I mean, there had been studies into whether or not the shuttle itself could be launched on a Saturn first stage. And in fact, there's a photograph of that mocked up in Into the Black. I mean, that's one thing I think I said I was doing when we last spoke about Into the Black, is the photo section. I'm really, really pleased with the way that the photos have turned out. I mean, that there's some really unusual stuff in there, like a mock-up of the shuttle on the back of a C5 Galaxy, which was one of the things they explored, a picture of the shuttle hanging beneath a specialized carrier aircraft called Virtus, made out of two B-52 fuselages that had been explored as a possibility.
Exactly.
They're all photographs in there. So there's one other, why the shuttle? I think I've answered that, haven't I? I mean, it was, you know, it was...
I think so.
It was awesome, was the reason.
Well, there you go, Tumbles. Let's go back up the list then to Matt Willis. Don't know if you know Matt, naval air historian, Roland.
I do. I mean, through Twitter. Yep, I do.
Yep. Co-writer on The Aviation Historian. He says, was there anything that arose in your research that really surprised you or went against the accepted narrative of the space shuttle's career?
I mean, a handful of things, and some of them we've sort of touched on in the course of the conversation. But I suppose the thing that really surprised me, or the thing that I don't think I'd appreciated, was the extent to which, in my view, the shuttle did more than it had ever been expected to, and accomplished far more than it had ever really been designed to. I think that you sort of look at the numbers of people that Saturn rockets put into space. I mean, you can sort of count them on your hands and toes. You know, the shuttle launched hundreds of people into space, and it built a space station. It flew a number of sort of 2-week missions. It put the Hubble Space Telescope up there and repaired it. I think that through the shuttle's career, we learned to sort of live and work in space. And accept space as somewhere it was more normal to be than we ever had through the Apollo program, where it was, as remarkable as it was, and I've certainly come to appreciate in a way that I never had. As remarkable as it was a very, very specific goal that was had in mind, and the kit that was developed for Apollo really had no flexibility to it at all. It had a very, very specific goal in mind, and it was the bare minimum it was possible to use to achieve that goal, and it did it brilliantly and successfully. The shuttle, on the other hand, had flexibility and adaptability built into it. And as I say, you know, its size alone, it was enormous. Its size alone meant that it could be things like a space station through carrying Spacelab for 2 weeks at a time. It could launch defense satellites. It could launch telecommunication satellites. It could fly higher to reach the Hubble telescope and repair it. It could build a space station. It just allowed us to do all sorts of things that the space and the lifting ability of the shuttle provided that previous generations of manned rockets simply hadn't. And I think there's one of the reasons why it was so important for me to try and celebrate it as this sort of incredible accomplishment, you know, really the last great achievement of the Apollo generation. You know, Alan Shepard flew in 1961, the shuttle first flew in 1981. All of the same people were involved in the shuttle's development. All the names that you see through the Apollo program were there for the shuttle, by and large. And it did, through its success, stop us somehow getting as excited about space as we've now started to become again, happily. It became normal and then surprised us when on two occasions, obviously, things went tragically wrong. But between and after those two awful tragedies, the shuttle did remarkable things, and it did them over and over and over again, and we stopped appreciating that.
Right, one final question then, Roland, and then we'll have to crack on. I know there were many others, but I think time's running out. From Steve McMillan, he says, I'd like to ask, what was the most surprising fact, the one fact that Roland uncovered in his research?
You asked me this last time round, and the answer I gave then was that Deke Slayton's favourite aircraft was the P1, the British P1, the sort of precursor to the Lightning. I particularly enjoyed discovering that Eric Winkle Brown had been offered a slot on the X-15. That was sort of unusual, but I'm struggling to come up. With something new. I'm sort of drawing a blank. What was the most amazing fact? All of them were amazing. I'll tell you. All right, here's something that I really, really enjoyed discovering. That was what NASA's plans were. The plans that were reduced and reduced and reduced and reduced into what was, eventually the space shuttle. When Nixon came to power and first asked NASA to draw up plans for the future of America's space program. What NASA proposed was a manned mission to Mars, and they were very specific about when they wanted those 12 astronauts to arrive. That was going to be by August the 14th, 1983. The manned mission to Mars, a 50-man space station as an orbiting terminus for deep space missions, a nuclear-powered spacecraft to ferry people from that space station to and from the moon, space stations in orbit around the moon, and moon bases. That was what they said, in the sort of excitement around Apollo, where it felt as if everything and anything was possible, they asked for. And Nixon just, one of Nixon's advisors in response to NASA's plans, claimed that NASA must be smoking pot. That was something which was in the, in the documents. I don't think I use the word pot, smoking something. And then the other story I really loved, just because it seemed to me it connected all sorts of different parts of the space, the story of NASA space exploration, was at the time where it was NASA, that Skylab, the first American space station, was going to be coming back to Earth more quickly than they had anticipated as a result of sunspot activity, starting to see the atmosphere sort of claw at Skylab and see her orbit getting lower and lower and lower, and eventually she was going to come on sort of unreturned re-entry, uncontrolled re-entry. They thought that if they could boost Skylab higher, they might be able to use the space station as a sort of destination from the shuttle and rejuvenate it and build it bigger. And it was a race against time between sunspot activity, ensuring that the date where Skylab returned to Earth got closer and closer and closer, and efforts to get the shuttle into space more quickly so that it could mount a mission to boost Skylab into a higher orbit. And the astronaut who was training for that mission to command it, and who loved it, and who described it along with his pilot as a real sort of Buck Rogers-ish mission, was Fred Hayes, who was the Apollo 13 lunar module pilot. So to see that Fred was through being the very first astronaut ever to fly the shuttle when he launched off the back of the SEA, the 747 in Enterprise, and flew down to Edwards Air Force Base. And to know that Fred did that and then was training for this orbital mission, and a really cool orbital mission at that, and was so stitched into the shuttle program, even though he's so associated with Apollo, was something I really, really enjoyed as well.
Well, Roland, sadly, we're going to have to leave it there. I know you swapped messages just before the show with Stephen Wood as well, so leave Stephen's question to one side, and we'll need to crack on. But fascinating read. Absolutely enjoyed it. Couldn't put it down as soon as I got it. So if you haven't read it yet, you're really, really missing out, because there's so much more we haven't had the opportunity to talk about than we have. And there are so many anecdotal stories in there that are sort of related, but just keep you going right the way through. So if you enjoy aerospace, if you enjoy space, this is the book to read. Roland, thanks very much.
Thanks so much, guys.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures, and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Not another flying magazine. The newsagents are stuffed with them. How can the aviation historian possibly be any different from the rest? Well, for a start, it's not a monthly, but a quarterly. It's compact format, not the usual A4, so it's great for reading in bed, in the bog, or in the bath. It doesn't cover the same old subjects, but tells you stuff you didn't already know. It's designed simply so it's easier to read, with no fussy backgrounds or overlapping images. And it's not in the newsagents at all. So check the website, theaviationhistorian.com, for more info. The Aviation Historian. It really is different from the rest.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
And so to the get involved and feedback section of the show, we've had loads of feedback for Jeanette on our last episode, of course, to Slip the Surly Bonds. Sadly, I can't go through it all now, but we have passed all of this on to Jeanette. So thank you to Gary Fairley, Dave Homewood, Mike Young, Steve Riley, Rab Austin, Ricardo Pina, Matt Bradshaw, and Isaac Alexander for all of that feedback, positive and negative as it was. Moving on, we talked in the last episode about books and book reviews and the Aviation Enthusiasts Book Club on Facebook. Lots of discussions on Into the Black there if you're interested. But this month's header book is from Eagle Aviation Publications, and it's the F4E Phantom Under the Skin Volume 1. Looks very impressive, so do look up this group on Facebook. And of course, some of the featured books from Eagle Aviation. Simon Jakubowski is doing a fantastic job on that group. Well done, Simon. Remember, tell us what you're reading at the moment on Twitter, on Facebook, hashtag AvBook. And Tumbles, again, came back in with a recommendation about 3 or 4 weeks ago. It's called The Big Book of X-Bombers and X-Fighters, the United States Air Force jet-powered experimental aircraft and their propulsive systems. couldn't get that one out. By Steve Pace. It looks like a big hardback, very picturesque book. He says, supremely good read, definitely recommend. So thank you very much for that, Tumbles. Okay, let's move on to promoting aerospace. First thing we want to give a shout out to is by Matt Folkus from the Airport Spotting blog, airportspotting.com. He's got a giveaway. If you like free books, he's got a free book to give away, the 50 best spotting locations. Now, Matt has written several books about spotting all around the world, and he's put one together as a giveaway. So if you get over to airportspotting.com and sign up there, you'll get a free copy of that book. One other thing we said we'd try and do a little bit more of is mentions for local airfields. These airfields don't have to be in the UK, by the way, so if you want a mention for your airfield anywhere in the world, give us a shout. This one is for my local. It's Compton Abbas, and they've got an American fly-in on the 11th of June. Their air racing is on the 9th of July, and they've got a vintage fly-in on the 6th of August. I should be at some of these, so if you want to meet up and have a chat, do let me know. Also, if you're interested in training to work their air ground radio, Compton are looking for someone mainly at weekends for help with their air ground radio station. Ideally, you'll hold a radio license, but they can provide training at cost. Expenses and food are covered, and the cafe there is pretty good. So if you're interested in volunteering for that role, drop a line to Emma at abbasair.com. If you have an event you want us to promote, or some news from your local airfield or from your local aviation or aerospace event, do drop us a line. Tim, any shout outs?
Got a couple of quick ones. Obviously, we're right on the cusp of this, so depending on when this episode goes live, but there is a fantastic space documentary about to hit UK screens. Very, very short screening, very, very limited screening. Last Man on the Moon.
Ah, yes. Brilliant.
Looks a real, really good, a real sort of the right stuff documentary on Apollo 17, and particularly Gene Cernan. Opening on the 8th of April, 11th of April, and then sort of finishing opening on 8th of April, finishing on 11th of April. So it's really, really short. If this does come out in time, so you can get to it, lastmanonthemoon.com. If not, pester your local cinema, pester your multiplex cinema, pester the directors and the makers on Twitter. You know, maybe we can get a second run sometime. And the secondly thing I'd like to just mention, not really kind of promoting aerospace, but obviously we had the sad news earlier this year of the passing of Captain Eric Winkle-Brown, who, you know, personal hero, aviation test pilot legend, you name it. I just think if you don't know about Winkle, you pick up his autobiography, Wings on My Sleeve, and have a read of that, and it will just make your jaw drop.
It's Paul an amazing Beaver, book. Yeah,
Paul Beaver, one of our previous guests, did a tour de force lecture at the RAS recently, and he is apparently working on a biography of Winkle. Look out for that.
Tim, you can also download that lecture by Paul on the podcast. The Aero Society podcast. It's absolutely brilliant.
Well worth a watch of that.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. Anything, Roland, you want to give a shout out to?
I was going to mention Last Man on the Moon as well, actually. The screenings are sort of few and far between, but I'm certainly going to try and get to see it as well. It might be worth, and I don't know whether this is on YouTube as well, but talking of Eric Winkle-Brown, there was a fantastic BBC documentary, I think simply called Britain's Greatest Pilot, which was introduced by James Holland and produced by the BBC, Simon Winchcombe at the BBC. And if you can find that, it's essentially sort of Winkle in his own words, and is really, really worth watching. But on the subject of that biography, I've been talking to Paul about that with my other hat on as publisher at Penguin, and I hope very much indeed that that Paul and I will be working on that together. That's certainly my ambition, and if I can steer it in the direction of Penguin Books, I certainly will.
Yahoo.
good luck on that one. Well, thanks very much, guys. Okay, it's time to wrap up then. Just before we go, though, I just wanted to mention that Gareth was due to join us this evening, and you won't get a bigger space geek than Gareth. Sometimes I like to think I am, but he's certainly the man. Very disappointed not to be with us this evening. As some of you are aware, Gareth hasn't been too well. He's much better. He's on the mend and all is well, but had a little bit of a setback today, so couldn't join us, but he will be back very, very soon. So all our best wishes go to Gareth. Okay, that's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. You can find Extended on Stitcher.com, UKpodcast.com, thepoddirectory.com, and of course on iTunes. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. Okay, Roland, just before we go, where can we find you online?
I'm simply RolandWhite.com and at Roland White on Twitter.
And Tim, how about you?
I'm at RES Tim R on Twitter, and you can find the Royal Aeronautical Society, www.aerosociety.com.
And you can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter. And of course, you can find the show on Twitter and Facebook at Aviation Extended. And that's Aviation Extended, no leading E before the word extended. So do look us up. We do post material in between our shows on our Facebook page, as well as our Twitter feed. So if you're not following us, you are missing out. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Roland White.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye, everybody. See you next time.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
This is XTP Media.